Hamas picks a new political leader.
The move reinforces the radical path pursued since the October 7th attack on Israel. Sinwar, the architect of the most devastating attack on Israel in decades, has been hiding in Gaza, evading Israeli attempts to kill him since the start of the war.
Plus, Russia reacts to Ukraine's progress in Kursk.
Meanwhile, the situation in the Kursk region in Russia escalates. Russian mail bloggers claim that the armed forces of Ukraine have occupied several settlements in the Kursk region.
And later, a look at the man who will lead Bangladesh's interim government and a conversation about how the media treats politics. Today is Wednesday, August 7th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Yahya Sinwar has been named as the successor to former Hamas political chief Ismail Haniyeh. Haniyeh was killed last week in Tehran. Iran and Hamas blame Israel for his death, though Israel hasn't publicly confirmed or denied involvement. Sinwar was the architect of the October 7th terror attacks on Israel that sparked the current war in Gaza. He's viewed as a hardliner and a fighter. Though his current whereabouts are unknown, it's believed he's been hiding out in the vast tunnel network underneath Gaza. Leila Shakroshahi of Reuters has more.
Hamas appointed Yahya Sinwar as its new political leader on Tuesday, as the successor to former chief Ismail Haniyeh, who was assassinated in Tehran last week. The move reinforces the radical path pursued since the October 7th attack on Israel. Sinwar, the architect of the most devastating attack on Israel in decades, has been hiding in Gaza, evading Israeli attempts to kill him since the start of the war. News of Sinwar's appointment came as Israel braces for a likely attack from Iran following the killing of Haniyeh in Tehran. It may also reinforce Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu's insistence that Israel must pursue its campaign in Gaza to the end. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said a ceasefire must be the primary goal.
With regard to Mr. Sinwar, he has been and remains the primary decider when it comes to concluding a ceasefire. And so I think this only underscores the fact that it is really on him to decide whether to move forward with a ceasefire that manifestly will help so many Palestinians in desperate need, women, children, men, who were caught in a crossfire of Hamas's making in Gaza.
Sinwar, who has spent half his adult life in Israeli prisons, was the most powerful Hamas leader left alive following the assassination of Haniyeh, which has left the region on the brink of a wider conflict after Iran vowed harsh retaliation. Israel has not claimed responsibility for the assassination, but it has said it killed other senior Hamas leaders. Born in a refugee camp in the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis, 61-year-old Sinwar was elected as Hamas leader in Gaza in 2017, after gaining a reputation as a ruthless enforcer among Palestinians and a ruthless enemy of Israel. Israel's chief military spokesman, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, blamed Sinwar for the October 7th attack and said Israel would continue to pursue him.
That's Leila Shakroshahi of Reuters reporting for us today. Also weighing in on Sinwar's new job is John Kirby, the U.S. National Security Council spokesperson. He spoke with VOA's chief White House correspondent, Patsy Wiedekuswara, in a press call earlier on Wednesday.
And just on Sinwar, can you give your assessment on his selection as the new leader and what you think that might do in terms of ceasefire prospects?
Man's a terrorist. He has an awful lot of blood on his hands. This guy was the architect of the 7th of October attacks in Israel. And some of that blood on his hands is American blood. He has always been the chief decision maker when it comes to negotiations over the course of these now 9 months. So, in effect, nothing really changes in that regard. And as the chief decision maker, he needs to decide now to take this deal, to get a ceasefire in place, to get some of those hostages home, and to get us all an opportunity to get more humanitarian assistance in. He needs to accept the deal.
And speaking of political assassinations, a federal criminal complaint was unsealed on Tuesday. It detailed an alleged plot ordered by Iran to kill a prominent politician or U.S. government official on American soil. VOA's Jeff Selden has details from Washington.
Charging documents unsealed Tuesday say 46-year-old Asif Merchant spent 2 weeks in Iran before flying to the United States in April looking for help to target multiple government officials and politicians. The plan, according to prosecutors, had three parts: steal documents or computer files from the target's home, plan protests, and then kill the targets on U.S. soil. The White House declined to comment on specifics of the case, but said countering the danger posed by Iran has been a top priority.
We have said many times that we have been tracking Iranian threats against former politicians. We've been very clear about that.
Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says many of the threats have been linked to Iran's desire to get revenge for a 2020 U.S. airstrike in Baghdad that killed Qasem Soleimani, a key Iranian military commander.
We have invested extraordinary resources in developing additional information about these threats, disrupting individuals involved in these threats, enhancing protective arrangements and potential targets of these threats, engaging with foreign partners, and directly warning Iran.
When contacted by VOA, the suspect's court-appointed lawyer declined comment. But court documents say Merchant told an informant he can make up to $100,000 and that he paid two undercover officers posing as hitmen a $5,000 advance. And while the papers never identify which U.S. officials were on Merchant's hit list, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee said in a statement that this case was the one that prompted the U.S. Secret Service to enhance security for former President Donald Trump. U.S. officials arrested Merchant July 12th, a day before an unrelated assassination attempt targeting Trump during a campaign rally in western Pennsylvania. Even with Merchant in custody, however, some analysts are bracing for more.
Much like Iranian projectiles, sometimes quantity has a quality of its own.
The Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Benim Ben Talablu, points to previous Iranian plots targeting former U.S. National Security Advisor Ambassador John Bolton, Iranian dissidents, and others.
On the one hand, some of these things may sound cartoonish or too far-fetched, but on the other hand, there's a persistence behind it, which is worrisome.
Top U.S. officials agree, the FBI director telling lawmakers just last month, quote, "I expect there will be more coming." Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, in Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky reports a surge in Ukrainian drone attacks, and there are conflicting reports from the Russian Kursk region. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv has the latest.
In his evening address, President Volodymyr Zelensky said he held a meeting with the military and received a report from the commander-in-chief of the Ukrainian armed forces, Oleksandr Sirsky, who is currently at the front line. According to the report, the toughest places are the Pokrovsk and Torezk areas in the Donetsk region and the Kharkiv region. Zelensky also reported that in July, Ukrainian armed forces used more drones to attack Russian positions and equipment than the Russian forces did to attack Ukrainian armed forces. This is the first time that Ukrainian officials have officially confirmed this information. Zelensky also said that the Ukrainian government has already contracted 1 million drones for this year, and more will follow by the end of the year. Meanwhile, the situation in the Kursk region in Russia escalates. Russian mail bloggers claim that the armed forces of Ukraine have occupied several settlements in the Kursk region. However, this was not officially announced. The Russian Ministry of Defense confirmed the destruction of Ukrainian armored vehicles. Contrary to these reports, local authorities said that the fighting was still ongoing. The Ministry of Defense of Russia initially stated that the Ukrainian subversive and intelligence groups retreated back to its territory after an alleged attempt to break through the Kursk region border, while the forces of the Russian Federation are attacking the Sumy region of Ukraine. Sumy region officials reported the downing of a Russian helicopter, a ballistic missile, and two drones over the region. A while later, the Russian Ministry of Defense deleted the information about the retreat of the Ukrainian forces, and the regional authorities stated that the situation on the border remained tense but under control. Also, videos of interrogations of Russian servicemen who say they were captured in the Kursk region appeared in the Ukrainian Telegram channels. A number of Russian Telegram channels identified some of them, but the Russian authorities did not officially confirm this. Alexei Smirnov, the acting governor of the Kursk region, said on Wednesday that he had reported to President Vladimir Putin on the situation after a major attack by Ukraine. He also said that the situation in the region is under control. He confirmed that over 200 people had been evacuated from the active combat zone. All these, as Russian mill bloggers claim that Ukrainian forces which entered the Kursk region of the Russian Federation in the early hours of August 6 have secured the positions in the border zone. In particular, Telegram channels close to the Russian Ministry of Defense reported that units of the Ukrainian armed forces allegedly occupied the villages of Nikolaeva Daryna, Sverdlikova and Daryna in the Sujan district within a radius of 4 kilometers from the border. Russian mill bloggers claim that the width of the front in the Kursk region is 10 to 11 kilometers, and on a narrow front, the armed forces of Ukraine advanced 10 kilometers west of the city of Sudzhi. According to various reports of the Russian mill bloggers, one or two battalions of the armed forces of Ukraine entered the territory of the Kursk region. Ukrainian officials neither confirm nor deny Ukraine's involvement in these events. At the moment, the Ukrainian side has not provided any official comments regarding the situation in the Kursk region. In the meantime, Russian forces conducted another drone attack across Ukraine in the early hours of August 7. Ukrainian air forces reported they destroyed all 30 drones launched by Russia in the Kyiv, Khmelnytska, Vinnytsia, Mykolaiv, Kherson, Kharkiv, and Cherkasy regions. As a result of the falling fragments of Russian drones, one person was injured and 22 private houses were damaged in the Kyiv region. Anna Chernikova, VOA News.
You're listening to Flashpoint on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A look at political coverage in the media coming up. Now, more on the turmoil in Bangladesh. Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina resigned and fled the country Monday following over a month of protests and hundreds of deaths. Mohamed Yunus is a Nobel-winning banker and economist. He's been called upon to lead Bangladesh's interim government. Gabe Singer of Reuters takes a look.
Bangladesh's Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina resigned and fled the country on Monday following weeks of deadly protests. They began as student-led demonstrations against government job quotas, but they quickly surged into a movement demanding both Hasina's resignation and that her arch-rival, a Nobel Prize winner named Mohamed Yunus, helm an interim government. Yunus has accepted the request, but what do we know about him? Yunus has been called the banker to the poor and a pioneer of the global microcredit movement. Microcredit lending is the idea of extending small loans to very poor people, often small business owners. Yunus and the Grameen Bank he founded won the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize for helping lift millions from poverty by providing microloans to Bangladesh's rural poor. Their lending model has since inspired similar projects around the world, and Yunus started Grameen America, focused on U.S. women living in poverty, in 2008. As his success grew, Yunus flirted briefly with a political career and attempted to form his own party in 2007. His ambitions were widely viewed as having sparked Hasina's ire, who accused him of, quote, sucking blood from the poor. His critics have also said his microlenders charge excessive rates and make money off the poor. But Yunus said the rates were far lower than local interest rates in developing countries. Hasina's government removed him as head of Grameen Bank in 2011, saying that at 73 he had stayed on past the legal retirement age of 60. thousands of Bangladeshis formed a human chain to protest his ouster. Yunus was already in the spotlight this year, facing a slew of legal troubles. He was sentenced in January to 6 months in prison for labor law violations. Then in June, he and 13 others were indicted on charges of embezzlement from the Workers' Welfare Fund of a telecoms company he founded. The same month, Yunus discussed his legal troubles in an interview with Reuters.
And the cases are very flimsy, made-up stories. I've stolen money, forgery, embezzlement, cheating the rights of cheating the labor, not giving them their proper money that they deserve.
Though he was ultimately not jailed in either of those cases, Yunus still faces more than 100 other cases on graft and other charges. In the June interview, Yunus was openly critical of Hasina and the state of Bangladeshi politics.
Well, Bangladesh doesn't have any politics left. I mean, there's only one party who's active and occupy everything, do everything, get to the elections in their way.
Following Hasina's exit, Yunus told Indian broadcaster Times Now that Monday, August 5th, marked the, quote, second liberation day for Bangladesh after its 1971 war of independence from Pakistan.
That's Reuters' Gabe Singer. And while the protesters are happy that Sheikh Hasina has left, others in Bangladesh have other issues to contend with. The political turmoil and violence that brought Dhaka to a standstill has closed many of the country's garment factories, the nation's largest export earners. Razia Begum works in one of the factories that had to close.
During this movement and clashes, our factory was closed and lost a lot of money. We went out of work, sitting idle at home. We were scared. We are poor people depending on daily wage and overtime. If we sit back home, how can we run our families?
Along with the hardships for individuals who find themselves out of work, others are worried about the national economy and the work stoppage's effect on the global retail market. According to the Bangladesh Garment Manufacturers and Exporters Association, the ready-made garment industry accounts for 83% of the country's total export earnings. There are upwards of 40,000 garment factories in Bangladesh, making clothes for international brands including M&S, Zara, Tesco, Aldi, Adidas, Puma, and Nike. Elsewhere in Asia, more than 120 people have died of heat stroke in the Tokyo metropolitan area in July. That's when the nation's average temperature hit record highs and heat warnings were in effect for much of the month. The Tokyo Medical Examiner's Office said on Tuesday that many of those who died were elderly. And finally today, a look at how the media covers politics. Many on America's right were critical of the media for not being tough enough on Joe Biden when they thought it was clear that his condition was declining and he was not fit enough for another term as president. Similarly, many on the left feel that the media is not vocal enough about what they see as the consequences for democratic institutions should Trump win a second term. Can they both be right? For some context, I spoke with media critic and opinion writer for The Washington Post, Eric Wemple. Does volume of coverage equal public understanding? I mean, you list out all these articles and TV segments about this, what a Trump presidency might look like. But if they're not really resonating, if they're not in the mainstream media where everybody sees them, what point do they have? How good are they?
I think that's a great question. I think that that is where a lot of the discontent comes from. Like, there is a certain disconnect between the volume of the coverage and sort of like what we see just sort of anecdotally in terms of public concern about this. Like, you know, we see tons of coverage. And at least in the eyes, apparently in the eyes of the critics, they don't see a lot of alarm, public alarm. Or the argument is that these stories aren't breaking through. Well, I have to say that our job as in the media is to put the truth out there, to write it as compellingly as possible. And if it doesn't break through, it doesn't break through. okay? And, like, it's not our job to all of a sudden decide, this isn't moving public opinion significantly enough. We need to change our strategy. We need to either, we need to do 15 stories in 2 days to really pump this into the, into the bloodstream of the American public. We need to write more grabby headlines or more clickbaity headlines. I would argue we should not do that. I would argue that we should do responsible journalism, compellingly written, put it out there. And if the public doesn't care, then the public doesn't care. I mean, there's only so much activism you could expect from the American media, and this is one of the complaints I have about some of this griping, is that it seems to be a response to the failure of the U.S. public to be utterly up in arms about Trump's plan for second terms. I will say I am. these things really, really concern me. The Project 2025, the mass deportations, all this stuff, they really, really concern me. And I can't be responsible for making people read it. I do want people to read it. We want to make it as good a presentation as possible.
Well, the old adage, the media is the message, right? I mean, perhaps instead of an article, the medium is the message. Instead of an article in The Atlantic, perhaps they should put these on TikTok.
There are so many ways in which media organizations have tried to appeal to younger readers. And just putting stuff on TikTok, I mean, I think that a lot of news organizations do put stuff on TikTok. And, they do video presentations and so on and so forth. But But a lot of the coverage needs to be and has to be written coverage because, there's so much to do, and putting together massive amounts of videos takes a long time and a lot of resources. And there is only so much of that can be done. There's a lot of it that needs to be written in breaking news presentations, analysis, so on and so forth. If you want to get deep into the topic, for example, the New York Times has done, I don't know, maybe 6, 7, 8 of these Trump second term stories. They've all landed on page A1 of the newspaper. They've done podcasts on this stuff, and so on and so forth. And so, yes, I think that's a fair point. Do a better job on social media platforms that are geared towards young Americans. But again, I will say this again, that just because people aren't freaking out and parading into the streets does not mean that we need to, somehow start scrambling our workflow and so do something radically different.
Eric Wemple is a media critic and opinion writer for The Washington Post. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.